For me, it's a great pleasure today to have Sir Anthony Leggett in this informal seminar for us, and we have to thank very much Professor Leggett, because this was a very last-minute decision, the one of having this seminar, so it's a great opportunity for us. So I don't think I need to spend too much time in introducing Professor Leggett, which I think you all know for his fundamental contributions to low temperature physics, superconductivity, superfluidity, and the foundations of quantum mechanics. So I will not give the whole list and of course the whole introduction, but it's of course worth mentioning the Nobel Prize that Professor Leggett received in 2003. This was shared with Atticosov and Ginzburg, indeed, for superconductivity and superfluidity. And Professor Leggett is also member, a fellow of the National Academy of Science, of the Royal Society, of the American Physical Society, and the American Institute of Physics, and probably most prestigious institution in physics that you can imagine. have the honor of having Professor Leggett in the board. And so today the talk will be about macroscopic realism, non-invasiveness, and weak mechanics.
Thank you very much. As you saw, this talk was announced as very informal, which is a euphemism for very disorganized. as Dr. Tuber mentioned, it was fixed up rather late, and for that and other reasons, I didn't have the opportunity of making a set of these specific talks. So I've basically cannibalized various other talks, and written one or two you've read specifically for this, but as a result, I'm afraid it's going to be a little jerky. The sequence won't necessarily be smooth, etc., etc. So let me encourage you to interrupt at any time. Okay. I suspect you don't really need me to go in this audience to go much through the motivation for the question of trying to do experiments on quantum mechanics at the macroscopic level. I've just written down here a table which roughly corresponds to my classification of various attempted solutions to the quantum measure paradox. These are all solutions which assume that quantum mechanics is going to be going to essentially be the whole truth for the foreseeable future. In other words, that however far we push it in various directions, including directions towards our own direct experience, it will continue to give the right experimental answer. If you believe that, then basically the first question you have to ask is, do I believe that the formalism of quantum mechanics in some crude sense corresponds to anything out there in the real world, or is it simply a calculational recipe? And crudely speaking, I think you can classify solutions to the quantum measurement paradox by the way they answer that question at the microscopic and the macroscopic level. So, for example, the so-called many worlds Everett Wheeler interpretation answers, yes, it really corresponds to something in the real world, both down there at the level of atoms and also at the level of our more or less direct experience. On the other hand, those interpretations, which in some sense flow from the original Copenhagen interpretation, basically answer no at both levels. I don't know. I know that the Neo-Bohmian interpretation basically answers yes at the microscopic level. I don't know what it says at the macroscopic level. I've tried asking one or two exponents of the Neo-Bohmianism, and they always say, ah, yes, that's an interesting question, and they never get back to me. So I don't know what they think. The one I want to, I don't think we need in this audience discuss the pros and cons of most of these things, but I would like to say a word about what I call the orthodox or decoherence interpretation. I do have rather strong views on that, actually. We don't need to go through the algebra, you all know this. This basically the technical basis of the decoherence interpretation is that once you entangled your system, if you would only make measurements on your system, and if you entangle that system sufficiently with its environment, then basically you destroy all the coherence, and that allegedly solves the measurement, or as I prefer to call it, actually the realization problem, because it really isn't the problem is not specifically associated with measurement, it's simply associated with the fact that quantum mechanics appears in some sense to say things don't happen, and yet we know things do happen at the macroscopic level. So in the, if you go through a typical presentation of the orthodox argument, it will make this a bit clearer. The first step, which is usually stated explicitly, is that if you have a system which is interacting with some kind of complex environment, then the rate of decoherence will increase sharply with the size or the complexity or some other indicator of the system you're talking about, and so by the time you get to the scale of cats or counters or whatever, essentially the decoherence is complete. Step two, again, usually stated explicitly. Once decoherence is complete, then all experimental predictions are identical to those for a classical mixture. In other words, a state in which you believe that your system is in one of two states or the other, but you just don't know which for one reason or another. And step three, which is usually not stated, which is significant, is that therefore, by the level of cats and counters, etc., the system actually is in one of the available states with probability ci squared. As I say, that's usually swept under the rug, and people sort of move past it rather quickly as fast as they can. Just a few comments on the decoherence interpretation or solution. First of all, there's, I think, a fairly strong argument, which John Bell was rather fond of making, that the practical impossibility of measuring omega 1 cross omega 2, where omega 1 is some operator of your system, omega 2 is one of your environment. If you could measure that operator, it, at least in certain circumstances, it would, as it were, restore the coherence, as you know, for example, from the EPR bill setup. The standard decoherence argument essentially says that by the time you get to some kind of reasonably macroscopic level, that it simply isn't going to be possible to measure a non-trivial operator which involves both your system and the environment. In other words, you won't be able to, in some sense, extract the entanglement of your system with its environment. That may be true. In 1930, that would have been impossible. It would have been impossible to do this kind of measurement for photon pairs. Nowadays, it's commonplace. In 1999, many people said this kind of measurement was going to be totally ridiculous for squids. In 2011, there are dozens of experiments which do exactly that. So you shouldn't really rest your resolution of fundamental issues of interpretation of the quantum formalism on what is right now technologically possible or not. You could easily change. The second consideration, which I'd like to just mention, which is somewhat related to the first one, is the fact, which is, I think is not always appreciated, you may have a system which is interacting with some kind of environment, and as a result of that interaction, the reduced density matrix of your system may become pretty close to diagonal. However, that need certainly not preclude the observation of spectacular interference effects in the future. Here's an example, which is sort of rather trivial, but hopefully you're all rather familiar with it. Let's think about the neutron interferometer for a moment. A sort of standard textbook account of the neutron interferometer would say, well, you have a source, and you have two wave packets, sometimes representing the same neutron. Remember, in a typical neutron interferometer experiment, the neutrons do really come through one at a time. So... So you have one branch of your wave function going off in one direction towards what I've indicated as a slit, because it's not really that, it's some kind of a bit of silicon or whatever, but indicated as a slit. The other going through the other slit, and they will re-interfere and so forth. Now, if I ask, in the basis, in a basis in which two of my states correspond to the neutron being at one slit or the other, what does my density matrix look like at the time when it's passing this intermediate screen? If you just take the sort of naive textbook approach in which you just represent the neutron by a spatial wave function and nothing else, then the answer is that in that representation, needless to say, the diagonal elements of the density matrix are large, typically a half, but the off-diagonal elements are also large. In other words, you have a coherent amplitude for being at one slit relative to the amplitude for being at another. Well, okay, but wait a moment. This neutron actually has a spin, and associated with the spin is a magnetic moment. That magnetic moment is certainly going to interact with the blackbody radiation field. And as a result of that, you're certainly going to get entangled with it. Now, exactly what the degree of entanglement is going to be is going to depend on various details of your theory, for example, what your neutron form factor looks like, etc. But certainly, one would expect that the off-diagonal elements will be suppressed to a value which is considerably smaller than one. And yet, we all know that the neutron interferometer works really well, rather well, with visibilities on the final screen of the order of 100%. So how come? Well, I think it's fairly easy to see what's going on there. As the neutron beam splits apart, so the, as it were, the bits of the radiation field with which the two arms are entangled split apart. But this is an adiabatic process. As the beams come together again, radiation field terms come together again. So you get basically 100% visibility on your final screen. A second problem, which you can actually work out in some detail, which illustrates the same basic point, is standard spin boson problem, particle in two wells with some kind of tunneling matrix element between them, in contact with a bath of harmonic oscillators whose cutoff, however, is what happened to the laser pointer? Yes, here we are. whose cutoff is high compared to the tunneling splitting of the system. Now, you can very plausibly write down for an approximate solution of that problem a Born-Oppenheimer type of approximation, so that at any one time, crudely speaking in words, the description is a coherent superposition of states in which the system is on the left, let's say, and on the right, and the environment has adiabatically pulled itself over to accommodate that, plus a similar term where the system is on the left and the environment has accommodated itself in a different way. Now, generally speaking, the overlap of the two oscillator states involved might be something like the exponential of the Frank-Condon factor, and typically this expression might be very small compared to one. So, at the time, and it will be a time, in fact, when B and A are roughly equal in magnitude, then the reduced density matrix of the two-state system, the spin, is this, something like this, with very, very tiny off-diagonal elements. So essentially, you could say, well, it looks like total decoherence has taken place. Well, not true. If you allow further evolution of the of this density matrix, there'll be no effect of interference between plus and minus. It, in fact, despite the fact these terms are incredibly small, after an appropriate time, you'll actually find the system has actually gone coherently from right to left and back again, so forth. All that's happened, really, is that the dressing effect of the environment has simply lengthened the period of the oscillations. It hasn't changed their coherence in any way. So again, you have to be very, very careful in trying to infer from what the density matrix looks like at a particular time what's going to be happening in the future. However, I think there's actually a much worse problem with the decoherent solution, and that's one thing I'd really want to emphasize a bit. Step three. Step three basically says that since the prediction for all experimental quantities is the same as they would be if the system were in a definite state I with probability ci squared, therefore it is indeed in a definite state I with probability ci squared. Now if you think about it, that's a gross logical fallacy, or a gross lacuna. What it does is to confuse the meaning of the quantum mechanical formalism with the evidence that a particular meaning is correct or incorrect. Microscopic level, the level of electrons or neutrons or whatever, unless you are a Bohmian, on which point I claim you have to make some rather extreme contortions, you can't interpret, and most people don't interpret, the meaning of a quantum superposition as saying that each system of your ensemble was definitely in one state or the other. Why not? Well, the evidence against that interpretation is, of course, the well-known phenomenon of interference. By the time you got to the macroscopic level, the evidence against the interpretation has gone away. If you try to do that same experiment with billiard balls, then for all sorts of reasons, but in particular because of the decoherent effect of the environment, you're not going to get all these nice interference patterns, you're just going to get a rather dull average curve. However, the formalism of quantum mechanics hasn't changed one bit on going from the micro to the macroscopic. So the question is, just because the evidence has disappeared, does that mean we're entitled to fundamentally reinterpret the meaning of the quantum mechanical formalism? I claim not. I mean, it's like arguing that if during a murder trial the vital piece of evidence which would have convicted the accused has suddenly for some reason mysteriously disappeared, that means he's become innocent. Not true. So I don't think you can do this. Well, okay. The upshot of all this, which probably most of you don't really need to go through, is that at least for some people, including me, there exists no entirely satisfactory solution to the realization problem, which depends on the assumption that quantum mechanics is the whole truth about the world and is going to go on being the whole truth as far as we want to push it. So then clearly we have to try to consider a possible alternative point of view, and very crudely speaking, that would be that at some point along the way between the level of the atom and the level of our own direct consciousness, something else comes in. Well, what's that something? We don't know. But there are various specific theories, of which probably the best known, of course, is GRWP, Girardi, Ribney, Weber, Pearl. I won't go into the details of that, but all these theories, any theory of this type, which has been developed to any degree, has to basically do two things. Well, it's got to do more than two things, but it's certainly got to do these two. It's basically got to agree with quantum mechanics at the atomic and subatomic level. Basically because, well, we all know that quantum mechanics works really rather pretty well down there. Nowadays, it's actually got to do rather more than that. It's got to agree at least to an extent at the mesoscopic level. But at the same time, it's got to affect the realization of a single definite outcome of at some level between the level of the atom and the level of our own direct consciousness. So where exactly that depends on the specific theory, of course. But so there's some interest, I think, then, in seeing how far we can push quantum mechanics towards the level of our own direct experience and whether it still holds up when we do. And there have been a number of systems which have been used for this purpose. I should say, with one exception, all of them since 1999. In fact, this is really rather recent. From the experimental point of view, this is really rather recent subject. And there are several more which are currently being proposed along these lines. So let me just review at this stage a few of the systems which people have used or are going to use. The most direct extension of the classical microscopic Young-Slitz experiments are the beautiful molecular diffraction experiments, which have been carried out in particular by the I think only to date by the group in Vienna with Anton Zeilinger and Markus Arndt and their colleagues. This is basically just a standard Young-Slitz experiment, with the difference that it's actually done with really quite complex and heavy molecules, not just atoms. Incidentally, does anyone know what was the when the first diffraction, or at least interference type experiment, was done with molecules, any molecule? Anyone know that? Now, the answer is quite interesting. 1929, actually. Esterman et al. With H2. So this is as small as possible, but it is a molecule, nevertheless. Anyway, but these are really quite rather more complex.
Did they see the interference factor?
They saw, I'm just trying to remember, it's basically a crystal diffraction experiment. So they saw, I think, what, you know, still looks like reasonable evidence of diffraction. So these are really rather more complex molecules. Fluorines, small molecules, some of them of biological significance. Typically, molecular weight of the order, right now, of the order of something like 60 or 70, but there are very good prospects of going quite a bit further there. And you don't see, you don't see the nice textbook-type stripes that we see with, say, ordinary optical interference, but it's pretty clear that this is an interference pattern, at least. Two interesting points about this experiment. First of all, you might think, and I did think when I first learned about these experiments, that to make them work, to get anything which is at all resembles a diffraction pattern, you're going to have to do a pretty good job collimating and monochromating the beam. Turns out not true. In fact, you can just use the beam coming out of a standard oven, and the dispersion is sufficient to give you a reasonable effect here. Second point, which I think is even more interesting, relates to the question of which wave effects. Your oven here is typically about 900 to 1,000 K, or at least it was in the original experiments. So there are many vibrational internal modes of your fullerenes excited. Now, most of those are pretty harmless because they don't interact much with anything outside. But there are four, but a typical C60 has four infrared active modes, and those actually absorb or emit several radiation quanta on the passage through the apparatus. Now, so you might ask, well, doesn't that constitute a which way measurement? And if so, shouldn't it, according to the standard precepts of the quantum theory of measurement, destroy the interference pattern? And the answer is rather amusing. You can probably guess what it is. The wavelength of the photons that are emitted or absorbed in the original experiment is large compared to the spacing between the slits. So it does not constitute an efficient which-way measurement. However, they were very, well, of course, the experimenters were very conscious of this point, and in a later round of the experiment, they actually, well, first they heated the oven, which doesn't have a huge effect, but they also increased the distance between their two slits by a fairly large factor, and sure enough, the interference effects go away. So that's pretty nice demonstration, I think, of the general ideas about decoherence and so forth. So as I say, right now, these are at the level of molecular weight, something like 60 to 100. Marcus Arndt and company do have substantial hopes they can go way beyond that in the future, and we'll see how that goes. A second system, which I'll mention rather briefly. This is the oldest. Historically, this is the first system for which some kind of quantum effects at the macroscopic scale were claimed in the literature, as far as I know. This is the work on magnetic biomolecules by Guido et al., David Avshalom's group. And the first experiments were way back in about 89, I think. This paper is in 95. These are done on magnetic biomolecules, in fact on horse spleen ferritin. And if you ask why horse spleen ferritin, well, I think the answer is that at least until quite recently, the horse was much better at producing these molecules, as it were, to a particular specification than laboratory chemists were. So this ferritin has a so-called apoferritin sheath, which is basically some organic stuff which is magnetically inert. And then it has a core of something like 5,000 iron spins. And these are ordered mostly antiferromagnetically, but they do have a slight ferromagnetic tendency, so the total maximum magnetic moment which this core has is something like 204 magnetons. So the question is it possible to produce and demonstrate a superposition of states in which they're one way round and the state in which they've all turned around? You can try to calculate if you could have a superposition like this, then presumably this would indicate that you could, among other things, get tunneling between these two states, coherent tunneling, and you can work out an antiferromagnetic exchange frequency for this process, and you notice that the exponent, as you might perhaps guess, contains the number of spins there. And then because this is a magnetic system, the uniaxial anisotropy comes in a non-trivial way, and you get this expression here. So the raw data in those experiments was, first of all, the linear susceptibility, and secondly, the noise spectrum. And above about 200 mK, both of those were more or less featureless. Below about 200 mK, both of them develop a rather sharp peak at about 1 MHz. And the two features which I think really persuaded the experimenters that maybe they were really seeing this macroscopic coherence effect, this coherent tunneling between these two macroscopically distinct states, was, first of all, the dependence of the frequency on the externally applied magnetic field, which is what you would expect if this were happening. And secondly, the fact that, indeed, the log of omega zero appear to scale, to have a term which scales with the number of spins. They could actually adjust this. After the first experiment, people got rather better at making this stuff in the lab with different numbers of spins, so they were able to adjust this. So that may have been evidence for a macroscopic coherent effect, but I have to say, yes.
If you're only doing a measurement of the tunnel magnetization, how can you tell the difference between this and incoherent superposition,
like a
combination of those two states?
If it was an incoherent superposition, presumably it would not be associated with a specific tunneling frequency. I think that's the argument. I mean, these in some sense you can think of these things as like macroscopic spins. So they sort of regularly rotating. If you just made an incoherent mixture, then there would be no particular frequency of rotation. I think that would be their argument there. So I have to say, the raw. While I think people are happy about the raw data, the interpretation of the raw data, which this group gave, has been subject to considerable criticism in the literature. So I think that has to be have a question mark right now above that. You notice, incidentally, though, in this case, the data is on a physical ensemble. That is, you have lots and lots of these ferritin molecules. And you're measuring basically the summed magnetization of all of them. I think maybe since I don't want to run out of time for other bits of the talk. Yes, that is a.
Is the interaction, the antiferromagnetic and ferromagnetic interaction, is it rotation invariant?
No, it isn't. No, that's necessary to get this tunneling process occurring.
In fact. So it's not rotation?
No, it isn't. No. No, it's sort of uniaxial.
So it's a Z2.
Sorry?
It's a Z2.
Yes. Okay, I was going to talk a little about quantum optical systems, which are very nice systems, actually. These are experiments of Eugene Polzig and his group in Orcus. They were originally done really not consciously in this context. They were done more to try to illustrate quasi-macroscopic Bell-EPR type correlations between two systems, but they do have some relevance in this, but I think since I don't want to run out of time for the rest of the talk, I'll leave those out unless anyone particularly wants to hear about them. And let me go on now to what I've been myself particularly interested in and what's been in some sense the workhorse in this area, which is superconducting devices. Now I think one should be be aware here that, of course, as you all know, superconducting devices have played a certain role in recent years in the quantum computing scene, but not all devices which are of interest for quantum computing are of interest for QINDS here, so I haven't got to find the whole slide, I haven't got, quantum interference of macroscopically distinct states. Okay, we'll come to that in more detail later. Not all devices which are technologically of interest for quantum computing are of interest for this, nor vice versa. These devices do have rather considerable advantages. We understand the classical dynamics of the relevant macro variable, which is basically the circulating current, or equivalently the trapped flux in a squid ring. The intrinsic dissipation can be made extremely low. The well-developed technology. This is an important point, actually. The action in the technical sense of classical mechanics doesn't scale with a quantity I call d, which is basically the number of electrons behaving differently in the two states. And you do have the possibility of, well, again, I haven't defined this on another view, which I haven't had, but of a more advanced stage of the experiments, which we'll come to. So in these experiments, the macroscopic variable, as I mentioned, is either the total trapped flux in this squid ring or equivalently the circulating current. So the basic nature of the experiments which have been done so far goes something like this. You put some kind of external flux of an appropriate amount through your squid ring. The two states you're trying to superpose are ones in which there's a current circulating clockwise in one case and anticlockwise in the other, and the magnitude of that current is typically of the order of a few microamps. So what you're trying to look for is whether you can generate and test for a coherent superposition of the clockwise and anticlockwise circulating states. And that's been the nature of most of the experiments that have been done so far in this. Incidentally, of course, I should say it's been a bit of serendipity that this whole program, this whole foundational program, has been able to piggyback on the search for a quantum computer. Had it not been for the advent of quantum computing, I don't think the money would have been available to do these experiments, so that's rather fortunate. So the very first experiments, which were done to SUNY Stony Brook and Delft in 2000, basically were spectroscopic. The point here is that if you believe that at all times you actually don't have a superposition here, but an incoherent mixture of these two states, then your energy levels basically follow the Peck lines over here, and spectroscopy would then reveal the difference between these. If, on the other hand, you believe you've got a coherent quantum superposition, then you'll get standard level repulsion effect, and you'll get the green lines, solid green lines here. And again, you can detect that with a spectroscopic technique. And sure enough, both these experiments did give evidence that the levels were the coherent superposition type. More spectacularly, in the last few years, there have been real-time oscillations in which you basically, or evidence for those, in which you basically start the system, say in this state here, then you leave it to itself, and it evolves coherently between these two states. And if you then go back and switch your measuring device on at a later time, you find that you have an appropriate histogram, which is periodic in time. These are essentially Ramsey fringe type experiments. A number of those experiments have been done by now, and this is just there's no particular point to this graph except to show you the data are not something I made up, as it were. Here's some data from Cura, Squirt Allen, 2003, Ramsey interference type experiment. I think you have to be careful about interpreting this. What you are seeing here is not the coherent oscillations themselves. This is a typical Ramsey fringe experiment, and you're seeing the dependence on the distance between the two pi over two pulses. This only lasts for what, half a dozen oscillations. If you then go back and reinterpret it in terms of the actual ammonia type oscillations between your two states, well, if someone in 1999 had asked me to guess how many coherent oscillations you could reasonably get by 2011, I think I'd have said, well, you'd be lucky if you get two or three, actually. In fact, they get 500. So this has been enormously successful, this program. So these basically are the experiments which have been done so far. Other systems, I should just mention one other class of systems which is quite a bit discussed in the literature. These are mechanical oscillators. Some interesting experiments have been done with mechanical oscillators. You probably know about the one which was done at Santa Barbara last year, where they found evidence that they'd cooled a more or less macroscopic mechanical oscillator down to its ground state. And that's nice. I mean, it's a nice experiment, but one has to say it doesn't really involve anything that you would call macroscopic superposition with any reasonable use of the term. I think it's the zero point displacement is absolutely tiny. I think it's probably a few fermis, tiny compared to the actual size of the object. So I think from this point of view, they're perhaps not quite so interesting. A very recent proposal from Marcus Aspermeyer's group in Vienna is that you might be able to use an optomechanical technique to generate superpositions of a fairly decently sized little ball of matter over distances which are large compared to its radius. Now, if you can do that, that would really be interesting, and that would, in some sense, probably supersede most of these other systems, including squids. But right now, that hasn't been done. It is a proposal. I hope it will work. Just to look at the question, how macroscopically distinct are these systems we're talking about here? That's a slightly vexed question. And so I'm going to get my readers all confused, I'm afraid, if I'm not careful. One has to have some kind if you're going to sort of encourage people to pursue this field, you have to have some kind of figure of merit to say, how far are you along the road from the atom to Schrödinger's cat? Okay. People can make up whatever criteria they fancy. My own criteria are basically a combination of two different things. First of all, what I call extensive difference. That means, can I identify an extensive macroscopic, extensive quantity which has some kind of difference in the two states I'm trying to superpose, which in some kind of natural units, say atomic units, is large, 10 to the 6, 10 to the 9, whatever. Okay. For example, in the case of the squid, I might choose the circulating current, or I might choose the magnetic moment, and you could argue about which of those is more appropriate. However, that by itself doesn't seem to be totally adequate. Because, for example, if you take a single neutron in an interferometer and you ask about the displacement of the centre of mass, well, as it goes through the intermediate screen, it could easily be something like a metre. The distance between the two ports could be something like a metre. However, I think most people wouldn't think of the neutron interferometer as an example of quantum superposition at the macroscopic scale. So you do want something else. And what I've tended to use in the past is a criterion which I've called disconnectivity, which, crudely speaking, I first tried to define this way back in 1980, and I think in retrospect you can think of it as a sort of very crude, fumbling early attempt to define the idea of multiparticle entanglement. So crudely speaking, how many microscopic particles are behaving appreciably differently in the two branches of your superposition? Well, that's still a vague term, of course, and we have to try to pin it down further, and in a moment I'll come to one aspect of that. But if you look at these figures, you see that unless you count the ferritin experiments, and as I say, there are some question marks over those, that until 1999, all the experiments which had been done had only got up to figures of the order of 10 or so in both of these columns. I mean, the neutron interferometer scores in this one, but not in this one. Since then, these various systems I've been talking about have gone to rather considerably larger numbers. I'll come back in a moment to why I've put brackets around this figure here and this one here. But you see that, very crudely speaking, we are something like, say, 40% of the way on a logarithmic scale from the level of the atom to the level of a real-life Schrödinger's cat. Okay, which I think is not bad, actually, especially since, as I say, in 1999 we were nowhere like that. So there have been rather considerable advances over the last 10 or 12 years.
Yeah. Question
yeah.
So as you scale, because I guess you can do the experiment with different sizes, right?
Absolutely, yes.
Mm. And how does the coherence time scale?
Well, I think, in fact, it turns out that for most of the squids that are actually used in the real experiments, the decoherence probably doesn't come from the bulk of the squid at all. It probably comes from the junction, which may contain possibly tunneling two-level systems or some other junk that you don't really want. And so everything really depends on how clean a junction you can get, not on the actual physical size. Which is an advantage. I mean, if you're going for the Guinness Book of Records, that means it's easier to do it with a squid than with most of the other systems. You've just got to get a good junction, and then you can make your rings as large as you like. Okay, now there is a rather nice problem concerning this definition of disconnectivity, which I've tended to use. In the case of the squid, for example, I've tended to look at it in the following way. Well, you have all the Cooper pairs within the penetration depth, the London penetration depth of the squid, and in one, crudely speaking, in one of your two states, they're circulating clockwise, and in the other, they're circulating anticlockwise. So, crudely speaking, that is the number you put in that column, the total number of Cooper pairs. Another nice objection, which has been raised to that, by Korsbacken et al., Brigitte Whaley's group, in the last couple of years, which goes in the following way. How many single electrons, that was the question, which is a reasonable one, is what I was sort of asked but not really taking all that perhaps seriously enough. How many single electrons would you actually need to displace, to transform the anti-clockwise circulating current to the clockwise circulating one? So you can actually make that a little more precise. It just simply take the difference of the averages. Actually, you do want to put a monitor sign on this to make sense, but apart from that, that's okay. You just evaluate the difference in the occupation number of the different case states for the single electrons. And they point out in their paper, which is now published in Europhysics Letters, they point out that in all experiments to date with squids, this difference has only been of the order of 5,000 or less. And their comment is that this number is well below what is generally regarded as macroscopic. So I think that's an interesting objection. However, there's a rather amusing counter to it. Let's imagine the following. Imagine I take the smallest speck of dust that is visible to the naked eye with good illumination, no microscope, but reasonable illumination, etc. Okay, and I compare two states. In one of them, it's sitting at rest. In the other, it is moving at a rate which takes it across its own diameter in, say, a second. Now, question, are you prepared to regard those two states as macroscopically distinct? Can I take a vote on that? How many people think that is macroscopically distinct? Mm-hmm. How many? Okay, so all the rest of you think it's not. Okay, they're not macroscopically distinct. I'm quite surprised, actually, because, as I say, these are two states which I can actually distinguish with my naked eye over a period of 1 second. Okay, well, I'd sort of rather hope you were going to vote the other way, but never mind. Let's go on. Maybe. Okay. Let me just pretend for the sake of argument, you had voted in favour of these being macroscopically distinct. Then we apply the Korsbacken et al. Criterion here. And this is a rather general general result, which they sort of notice in their paper also, which basically says that this number W is of the order of the total number of particles involved, in this case the total number of particles in the lithium fluoride grain, multiplied by the ratio of the velocity difference, the mean velocity difference of the two states, to the characteristic velocity of the constituents. Incidentally, why did you only have to displace, let's just go back for a moment, why did you only have to displace 5,000 electrons, despite the fact that you have, as it were, a macroscopic current? Basically, the answer is that in both these states, most of your electrons are sitting way, way down there on the Fermi sea. Now, if you're talking about distinguishable electrons, of course, you have to displace all of them. But you're not talking about distinguishable electrons. They're indistinguishable fermions. That's why this number comes out so small. And this is embodied in this more general formula. Now, in the case of the lithium fluoride, the total number is something like 10 to the 16 here. Incidentally, do people know how small an object can actually be seen by the naked eye under good illumination? Anyone like to guess at that? Yeah, that's just about right, actually. Yes, 1.5 microns. That's the figure I get from my colleague in experimental psychology, Francis Wong, who's an expert on this kind of thing. Yes, that's about right. So that corresponds to roughly 10 to the 6th electrons plus nuclei. The velocity is about, I've actually been rather conservative here. I haven't taken 1 micron, I've taken 7.5 microns. So 7.5 microns per second. Now, the velocity of the electrons, typically, in lithium fluoride, it's a typical band insulator, velocity of the electrons is something like 3 times 10 to the 6 meters per second. What about the nuclei? This is the amusing bit. If you just think about the velocity of the nuclei, well, they have these root mean square vibrational states, and that's way down. That's something like 3 times 10 to the 3 meters per second. So that would then make this number, W, very considerably bigger than the number of 5,000, which we've got for the squid. So then one could reasonably say, well, indeed, this is not, even if you'd agreed that the lithium fluoride grain, states of that is macroscopically distinct, this is well below that. However, here comes the neat bit. If you really take the cause back and argument seriously, you shouldn't be thinking about the motion of nuclei, you should be thinking about the motion of nucleons. Then, of course, the mean square velocity of the nucleons within a nucleus is way, way higher. So this number gets cut way, way, way down, in fact, and the number which actually comes out at the end of the day is something like 1,500, comfortably below this one here. So if you followed that argument, you'd say, well, these squid superpositions are as macroscopic as the superposition of the states of the lithium fluoride grain. Now, of course, you come back to me and say, yeah, that's nonsense. You're really cheating. Whenever you have a bound complex like a nucleus, you should actually not count the motion of the individual constituents, you should count the motion of the complex as a whole. Fine. Then let's take that argument back to cause back in that L. Here, the electrons are part of Cooper pairs. Okay? So you should not be counting the electrons, you should be counting the Cooper pairs. Then you get back to the original number that I got. So in either case, whichever way around you want to play it, it comes out that the superposition in the squids is at least as macroscopic as the superposition in your dust grain. So I think it's quite an amusing result. Let me now actually speed up. I'm running out of time. Yeah.
You mentioned about the squid. The action doesn't scale with the size.
No, the action does not. No.
Action does not.
No.
Whereas would have maybe expected if it were like a center of mass.
Yeah.
It can scale.
Yeah, I mean, the reason it doesn't really is that when you think about the transition between these two current carrying states, at least for reasonable experimental parameters, most of the, I was going to say action, but I mean now action in an informal sense, most of the excitement takes place very close to the junction, in some sense associated precisely with the presence of the junction. So the rest is, in some sense, almost a spectator. Okay, let me now come to, oh dear, now I'm probably going to get mixed up. Let me now come to the following. So far, what have we seen? What we've seen in all these systems, including the squids, is that everything is consistent with the idea that quantum mechanics is still working and giving the correct predictions at whatever level we're talking about. In the case of the squids, at the level of whatever, 10 to the 7, 10 to the 9 particles. However, of course, that does not say that quantum mechanics has to be still right there. No, I'm very much a Popperian in my philosophy of science, and I believe that no finite number of experiments can ever prove quantum mechanics to be right. That's just a matter of simple logic, basically. However, with appropriate qualifications, a finite number of experiments could prove an alternative theory to be wrong. So let's, rather than trying to prove that quantum mechanics is right, why don't we try to prove that an alternative class of theories is wrong? Now, what's the most obvious alternative class? Well, something we might call macro-realism. So, crudely speaking, what we would like to do is to, first of all, define carefully what we mean by a macro-realistic theory, and then secondly, see if we can set up experiments to discriminate between quantum mechanics and macro-realism. The general idea, then, is to devise an experimental setup where the naive quantum mechanical calculation predicts quantum interference of macroscopically distinct states. Then to derive constraints which must be satisfied by an appropriately defined class of macro-realistic theories and which the naive quantum mechanic predictions violate. And then, of course, go ahead, hopefully, and do the experiment. Or persuade your experimental colleague to go away and do the experiment. So very crudely, here's how it goes. Here's a sort of very, very crude version of what one might want to do. One has a system which has available to it two states which we agree are macroscopically distinct. You start it off in a definite one of these two states. You leave it to itself, and you don't. What you're interested in, basically, is what its state is here. However, if you were to actually try to measure that directly, this would be incredibly difficult, because remember that these states are macroscopically distinct, so they differ in the behaviour of 10 to the whatever particles. So you'd have to do, if you could do anything, you'd have to do a tomographic experiment at the order of something like 10 to the 9 particles, which is totally out of the question right now. So what you do is you don't do that. You're lazy. You let nature do the work for you. You wait and let nature evolve these states. And if you've got your parameters right, then what you may find is that because of the characteristic quantum interference between these states, even though if you'd started here in this state, you would have had a finite probability of going here. If you'd started here, you would have a finite probability of going here. But the amplitudes interfere, and so you get zero probability of ending up here, and you always end up here. So in other words, you make your measurement only at some final time, and then infer back to what the system was doing at an earlier time. So that's the sort of general pattern of what we're going to try to do, but we'll, in fact, do something that's just a little different in detail from that. Before we do so, let's try to define the class of macro-realistic theories. What we need is the conjunction of three things. First of all, macro-realism per se. That basically says, well, we know it's an experimental fact that whenever we look at the system to see which of these states is realised, we always get one answer or the other. I mean, those experiments in the case of squids, say, have been done, so that's not a problem. So the statement of macro-realism per se is that on each experimental run, for any given time t, with a rather tedious qualification I won't go into, q of t takes a definite value. Q of t is plus 1 here, minus 1 here. Q of t takes a definite value, plus 1 or minus 1, whether or not we actually made an observation at that time. So that's basically the definition of macro-realism as such. Turns out, apparently, at least as far as I know, if that's all you say, then that is not quite capable of experimental test. If you want to add non-invasive measurability, which I'll hopefully say a bit more about later, there exist, at least in principle and hopefully in practice, ideal negative result measurements which can determine the value of Q of t without affecting the state or its subsequent motion. Let me right away emphasize, this is not a quantum mechanical statement. This quantum mechanical statement would be nonsense. However, I believe it makes a lot of sense as part of a complex defining a macro-realistic theory. We'll come back to that. Finally, induction. For the moment at least, let's say that's the statement. The properties of an ensemble are determined exclusively by initial conditions and not by the set of experiments which is going to be done later on the ensemble. So having got that, having made those definitions, I can now... Yep.
Yep. Question about why do you call it induction?
Sorry? Well, I don't know what else to call it, really. Really.
The causality property.
I think it basically is an assumption, it's sort of reaffirmation of our normal ideas about the arrow of time, that if I...
I'm just curious about the name.
No special. I mean, if you think of a better name, I'll take it. Yeah.
But you say it is an assumption about the arrow of time.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, I mean, we could call it just the common notions about the arrow of time. Right? Okay, so now we can try to derive some what you might call some temporal Bell inequalities. Let's consider a long series, that is a time ensemble of runs on a single macroscopic system with two macroscopically distinct states starting from the same initial conditions. And we'll again use the label Q for the quantity which distinguishes between these two states. So Q is plus one for one state, minus one for the other. We split our ensemble into three sub-ensembles. For sub-ensemble 1, we're going to measure Q at times T1 and T2, and we'll call the outcomes Q1 and Q2. For sub-ensemble 2, we'll measure at times T2 and T3 without measuring at T1. And for sub-ensemble 3, we're going to measure at times T1 and T3 without an intermediate measurement at T2. And from the data on the sub-ensemble 1, we can compute the experimental correlation of Q1 and Q2. Similarly, from the data on the sub-ensembles 2 and 3, you can compute the expectation value of the correlation of Q2 and Q3 and Q1 and Q3. And then you define a quantity which I call K sub X for experimental, which is a function of T1, T2, and T3, and is simply the sum difference of these quantities. Now, if we make the most naive quantum mechanical description of a two-state system with some no bias and some kind of non-zero tunneling amplitude, then irrespective of the initial state, that is of the ensemble we're talking about, the correlation is simply a function of the difference of times given by this standard formula. So far, so good. That's what quantum mechanics predicts. What does macro-realism predict? Well, by condition one, the macro-realism per se, on any given run, the quantities Q1, Q2, and Q3 simultaneously exist, whether or not they're measured, and they take the values plus or minus 1. Then it follows by simple algebra, nothing at all sophisticated, that on any given run, the values satisfy this condition. They're less than or equal to 1. Here's the tricky bit. If you now invoke your subsidiary assumptions 2 and 3, then provided the measurement is carried out non-invasively, the statistical properties of the three ensembles are identical. And what that means is that you can now identify the ensemble averages with the experimental averages. Okay? So the upshot of this is that... So any theory of the macro-realistic class will predict the Bell type inequality that quantity k, which we measure experimentally, is less than or equal to 1. Very, very similar to Bell's original 1964 inequality. On the other hand, that's violated by the quantum mechanical predictions for suitable choices of the TI. For example, if you take them to be one-sixth of a period, then the quantum mechanical expectation value is 3/2. So at first sight, at least, it's possible to discriminate experimentally between quantum mechanics and macro-realism. Now, you have a question?
So you had these three assumptions, and it seems like you have one that's sort of preferred, like that's the one that you're first willing to give up, this macro-realism one. Whereas I would say the non-invasive is one.
Fine, we can come to that. Yes, we can come to that. Mm-hmm. Okay, this is what I'm now going to say in the next few minutes is mostly of historical interest, but from my own personal point of view, it's quite important. I spent a lot of time thinking about these issues in the 80s and 90s. When we first, I and a few other people first started sort of propagandising along these lines way back around 1980, we got a lot of flack. We got a lot of flack in particular from the professional quantum measurement community. And here are some of the objections they made. First of all, this idea is ridiculous because everyone knows that by the time you get to the macroscopic level, the action in the technical sense of classical mechanics is huge in units of h-bar. And what that means is that the predictions of quantum mechanics reduce to those of classical mechanics. Well, A, that's not true, but B, even if it were true, we could still get around it. What we have to do is to find a system where a macroscopic variable is controlled by essentially microscopic energies, and that's precisely what happens, so for example, in squid, and so forth. So that doesn't work. Second objection, decoherence will kill you stone dead. As late as 1999, I'm told, went one of the experimental colleagues who actually did these experiments was very seriously and sternly advised by one of his senior theoretical colleagues. They didn't mention the name, but I think I can guess who. Someone who considered himself an expert on quantum measurement theory. He was advised that he was simply wasting the taxpayers' money. That these experiments with squids will never work because everyone knows that by the time you get to macroscopic superpositions, decoherence kills you stone dead. Well, if you now look back, of course, now one doesn't have to argue theoretically against this because the experiment's been done, so one knows for sure that's not true. But it is striking if you look back on the literature of the last 40 or 50 years that essentially, almost without exception, the professional quantum measurement literature has grossly overestimated decoherence whenever it occurs. For example, you get these what I call electron and Sirius arguments, which say that quantum macroscopic systems are so many energy levels, and the phase coherence between them has to be so delicate that the motion of a single electron on a distant star is enough to screw you up. Complete nonsense. First of all, although a macroscopic system indeed has densely spaced energy levels, most of those energy levels are probably irrelevant. For example, in the case of the squid, sure, you have all sorts of fermion degrees of freedom and so forth. They just are irrelevant from the point of view of this kind of phenomenon. Secondly, and more importantly, the adiabatic argument helps you a tremendous amount. It's true that you do have interactions with this electron Sirius, but those interactions are almost entirely adiabatic. So again, they don't hurt you. Come back. One final point, which is I think rather amusing, and this is actually crucial for the use of these Josephson systems as superconducting qubits. Take a block of niobium, a superconductor with a transition temperature of about 9 degrees. Take it down to, as you can sort of reasonably routinely these days, take it down to, say, a little below 10 millikay. Okay? Now I'm going to ask a question. You know that in general, a superconductor does contain normal electrons, and these are going to be a very effective mechanism of decoherence. In that block of niobium at 10 millikay, I'm not going to ask you what is the fraction of normal electrons. I'm going to ask you, I've got a 1 cm³ block here, how many normal electrons do I have? 0. Or more precisely, on average, 10 to the minus dot, dot, dot. There simply are no normal electrons there anymore. So things are not half as bad as they look. And almost all these quantum measurement people who objected to this idea were being far, far too pessimistic. Finally, there is, this involves an argument which probably is not, at least at the moment, is not needed. You do have a severe asymmetry in this program. If you can show that your experimental results support quantum mechanics, then you've basically killed macro-realism, at least at the scale of the experiment. Right? And I think there's fairly little argument about that. What if, however, the experiments appear to support macro-realism? then there are any number of letouts for quantum mechanics. Can one get around that kind of objection? In fact, one of my colleagues, who's not a condensed matter physicist, told me quite explicitly, I will never believe any refutation of quantum mechanics which comes from experiments on a condensed matter system. What he meant was, basically, they're just too messy, too ugly, too complicated, there are too many things you don't know about. It's not a stupid objection. How does one get around it? Well, there are ways of getting around it, which so far, luckily, we haven't really had to get to use. But what you can do is, instead of starting with a microscopic Hamiltonian, which is, you know, the sort of basic instinct which all of you who come from, say, particle physics or cosmology or atomic physics would do, you know, start off by writing down a microscopic Hamiltonian. From that, you derive the quantum behavior, and then, as an appropriate limit, the classical behavior in a classical experiment. Oh, fine. This is not a non-starter in this case. You just do not know enough details about the system to write down an accurate microscopic Hamiltonian. However, this is the nice bit. What you can do is to start from a classical experiment and try to work out enough properties of your microscopic Hamiltonian that you can then make confident predictions about the quantum behavior. For example, in the case of a squid, you start off by looking at its behavior, let us say, for small oscillations in the classical accessible regime. From that, you try to derive enough properties of your Hamiltonian to say, hopefully with confidence, what it's going to do in a quantum tunneling regime and so forth. Lo and behold, that does seem to work rather well. At least it has worked rather well so far. We don't actually need that, in fact, at least we don't yet, because so far, at least, as we've seen, the experiments have all come out basically in favor of quantum mechanics. But in the future, we might. Might need to do something like that. Okay. Sorry, I'm really going on a little bit of time. How long can I reasonably go on? I think just one or two things I really would rather like to say. Someone already mentioned the fact that perhaps rather than rejecting realism. Let's suppose that the experiment is done. It has not been. Incidentally, I have to say the experiment I'm proposing has not yet been done on any system where I would say you have two macroscopically distinct states. I'll just comment on that hopefully in a moment. Suppose it is done, and suppose it comes out according to quantum mechanics. Which of these principles do we reject? Do we reject macro-realism? Do we reject induction? Or do we reject non-invasive measurability? Okay. So the question that raises the interesting question, can one in any sense justify the assumption of non-invasive measurability? Remember, we're not trying to justify it within quantum mechanics. We're trying to justify it within the general context of a macro-realistic theory. And basically, there is a way, and I sort of vaguely commented this way back, but I made a sort of fairly short comment on this possibility, and there's a much more detailed discussion by Meisel and Wild, I think, recently in a preprint. Roughly what you do is this. You choose your initial state, and then you choose an intermediate time such that quantum mechanics predicts unambiguously the system is definitely, say, in the system plus. You check this prediction experimentally. If it doesn't work, then we're back to square one. We have to redo our quantum mechanical thinking, but let's suppose it does work. Then carry out two sets of runs. In series one, you start in this state at initial time, do nothing at the intermediate time. At the final time, you take the statistics of the occupation of plus and minus. Series two, again start in here, time ti. You conduct a measurement at the intermediate time such that your physical measuring apparatus couples only to the minus state here. And then you take the statistics at the final time and compare them with the first run. And then you repeat for a different value of the intermediate time where quantum mechanics says you're definitely in this state, completeness. Okay, and if the statistics of occupation of plus and minus at TF are identical for series 1 and 2, then it seems to me that the assumption of non-invasive measurability can be said to be reasonable within the context of a macro-realistic theory. Because if you denied it, what would you be saying? You'd be saying, I really believe that at all times the system is definitely in one state or the other. Whenever quantum mechanics says it's definitely in one state or the other, then my measurement is non-invasive. However, when quantum mechanics says it's not definitely in one state or the other, then my measurement is invasive. I mean, that It's a possible point of view, but it seems to me very unnatural. So I would say that when augmented with this kind of argument, in some sense, the assumption of non-invasive measurability does not go very far beyond the bare statement of macro-realism per se. Now, you could argue about that, I don't know. I think I'm really not going to have time to do much more, so let me stop. That's the projected experiment. What experiments actually exist? Okay. As I said, to my knowledge at least, there is no experiment of this type where the states in question are macroscopically distinct. However, there are two interesting experiments. The first experiment is by the Oxford group, it's not yet published, it's on the archive, where they've actually done a sort of realism test, not a macro-realism test, but a realism test on a set of nuclear spins. They've done it using this very neat technique, which is done at IQ, developed at IQC, I guess, by Laflamme, Corey, Musa et al., where basically you, in some sense, transcribe the correlations of your system onto the actual state, the final state of an ancilla. And they were able to do that with their nuclear spins by using an electron spin as their ancilla. And sure enough, they found that, to no one's surprise, the realistic inequalities were violated. So that's a very neat experiment, I think. But as I say, no one really is very surprised at that, since we all believe that quantum mechanics is working fine at that kind of level. There does exist one experiment on a macroscopic system, and this is Palacios Laloy et al., about a year ago now. There are two things, I think, which one has to worry about in that experiment. Well, not to worry about, but there are two things which are worth commenting on. It was done on a macroscopic system, that is, a macroscopic superconducting circuit. However, it's arguable whether the two states which they superposed were macroscopically distinct or not. Again, this depends to some extent on the matter of taste, what you count as macroscopically distinct. In their case, it was the basic element was a Cooper pair box, so we're talking about states in which a single Cooper pair has been translated through a distance of maybe a micron or so, or perhaps a little more. Okay. So whether you count that as macroscopically distinct, as I say, that's a matter of taste, perhaps. However, I think there's something much more interesting and significant about that experiment. It was not, everything I've said so far assumes implicitly that any measurements we're going to make are projective von Neumann measurements. This was not done that way. It was done using a so-called weak measurement technique. And I'm very, very confused, if you like, about what deductions one can make for an experiment done in that kind of way. I think one can make, one can certainly define a class of theories which is refuted if you find, as they did, the quantum mechanical results. I do not believe that class of theories is what I've called the class of macro-realistic theories. I think it's much, in some sense, has to make much stronger assumptions. In particular, I don't see how in that kind of experiment you get away without having a detailed theory of the coupling between your system and the measuring apparatus, which you don't actually need for the original a temporal Bell inequality violation. So personally, I think it's a very nice experiment, but I don't think it refutes what I would call macro-realism as such. And so I do think that it's very important to go ahead, as several groups are now thinking of doing, and doing a fully-fledged temporal Bell inequality measurement on a genuinely macroscopic system using projective measurements. If that happens, then I think we will be quite a bit further on the road from the atom to good old Schrödinger's cat. We'd be maybe 40% at least on logarithmic scale. Of course, you know, as physicists, we all know that if you want to make your results look good, you put them on a logarithmic scale. But it will be, I think, somewhat significant. So that's roughly where we stand in this field. And you know, welcome any general questions or comments.
Thanks a lot.
So, in order to create this macroscopic quantum states, still one has to put lots of effort.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
So, what one has proved is a matter of principle, the question of that at macroscopic level, non-classical states can exist.
What's been shown so far is that everything that at the level of squids or quantum optical systems or fullerenes or whatever you want to talk about, everything is consistent with the hypothesis that quantum mechanics is still working and that you do, that these superpositions of macroscopically distinct states are occurring. As I say, that so far at least, none of the experiments have shot down an alternative class of hypotheses. That's what we'd like to do.
So, I remember some more discussion. So, there may be surprises in biology. Without much effort, biological systems like photosynthesis.
Thanks for raising that. Yes, okay. Yes, very interesting question. I'm sure some of you are familiar with this. There are, to my knowledge at least, there are two areas of biology where a lot of discussion has been generated over the last two or three years concerning the possible effects of, first of all, quantum mechanics, and secondly, perhaps of entanglement, specifically. One of these areas is the first stages of photosynthesis, and the other one is bird navigation. I've talked to various colleagues about this. I've talked in particular to my colleague Klaus Schulzen, who was one of the first people to look at both of these things, actually way back around 1980. And he more or less, I think, confirmed, or my understanding of what he said, confirmed the sort of impression that I'd formed myself, namely that, sure, it's very likely that quantum effects are relevant to both of these phenomena. On the other hand, to say that entanglement is fundamental there seems to me to be, how to put it, it requires a rather unnatural warping of the description of the raw data. I mean, there are ways of doing it, but I'm not sure that they actually take you any further than just saying that quantum mechanics appears to be important here. But incidentally, since you bring that up, I think there's an opportunity to tell you about a really, really crazy experiment which we are doing at the University of Illinois. We being my experimental colleague Paul Quiert in quantum optics, my experimental psychologist colleague Francis Wong in experimental psychology, and me sitting there on the fringes, as it were, trying to comment. What we're actually going to try to do, we think for the first time, although you know, one can't be absolutely certain without having done an exhaustive search of the literature, we're going to try to see whether the statistics of photons as perceived directly by the human eye are the same as the statistics of photons perceived by an inanimate recorder. Needless to say, we did not apply to the National Science Foundation for the funding for this experiment. We did apply to the Templeton Foundation, it looks like we did again. So basically, here's the very sort of basic experiment. Well, the basic experiment, actually, interestingly, the first stage of the experiment was to actually learn a little more about the first the psychophysics of the first stages of human being, which, oddly enough, is not well understood at all. It's still controversial, for example, whether a single photon can really trigger an rhodopsin molecule. Anyway, that's stage one. But after that, what we're going to do is to basically sit a subject down, shine a beam of single photons into his or her right eye, okay? Record the what he or she tells us. Next, shine it into the left eye, do the same. Finally, and this is the crunch, we're going to shine a beam of photons which are in a quantum superposition states of left and right, and see if we get the expected results. Now, I think obviously our expectations of the chances of getting something which deviates strongly from the accepted wisdom about 1 in 10 to the 6, but on the other hand, were it to occur, it would be rather important. So hopefully that'll go ahead.
Is there any other question? If not, let's thank again.